Good morning. We're talking about caring for your health as you age. It's The Morning Show. I'm Molly Stentz, and for Kate Archer Kent. A century ago, the average life expectancy for people born in the U.S. was about 56 years. Today, it's risen to almost 79 years. As baby boomers age, the number of U.S. adults over 65 is expected to more than double by 2060, outnumbering children for the first time. Are you over 60? What health issues are you dealing with now? Here to answer your questions is Dr. Michael Dolan. He's the Executive Vice President and Medical Chief Operating Officer for Gunderson Health Systems in La Crosse. He also practices internal medicine. Good morning, Dr. Dolan.
Good morning, Molly. Thanks for having me on today. So, I've really been looking forward to this discussion since it pertains to myself and my fellow baby boomers.
So glad you could join us this morning. Well, where to begin? I want to ask you about cancer screening, something that has been on my mind over the past year during the pandemic. We know that a lot of people have deferred some of the basic health screens that you would normally go in to get, but with hospitals being full and with people being worried about COVID, I'm wondering what advice you have to those of us who maybe have put off getting those cancer screenings.
Well, there's no question that one of the major impacts that COVID and the pandemic has had on overall population health is the delay in cancer screenings. We've seen that. And it's not just people not being able to get in for their regularly scheduled appointments where most of these cancer screenings are set up, but it's also just the ability to get people into procedural areas like GI labs to get colonoscopies. We had to shut down in the initial stages of the pandemic for about 8 to 10 weeks. We did no screening colonoscopies. And then we slowly ramped up over a period of 4 to 6 weeks. And by the time that was all said and done, we were thousands of screening colonoscopies behind. And a year later, we're still digging out of that. So it's been really hard to both get things scheduled and also to get people in so that they can get those screening tests set up. But yeah, if there's any decade where cancer screening is really, really important, it's the 60s. If you look at the incidence of cancer for or by decade, it's really in the 60s that the incidence of cancer starts to increase significantly. Overall, cancer incidence doubles during the decade of the 60s. So the screening tests are really, really important.
And which ones in particular would you recommend?
Yeah, actually all of them. So, you know, if you look at what's common, and that's really the most important thing, is looking at what's common and where we have really good evidence that screening makes an impact on morbidity and mortality. It's breast cancer, it's colon cancer, it's lung cancer, it's cervical cancer, and maybe prostate cancer. That's a controversy that we can get into later. But all of those are really important. Without question, I think women that are 60 years of age really need to keep cervical cancer screening at the top of mind because they're really getting towards the end of cervical cancer screening. We still recommend that women between 30 and 65 get either a pap smear or HPV testing every 3 to 5 years, depending on which strategy your clinician uses to screen. And that should continue up to age 65. And there's a population of women that after the age of 65 probably ought to continue with cervical cancer screening. And those are women who've had precancerous lesions that were high grade, women who've had a history of cervical cancer or high grade lesions that were treated, women who are immunosuppressed due to any reason. Those are all women who I personally try to continue some form of cervical cancer screening going forward. On top of that, you know, mammograms, annual mammograms are covered by private insurance and Medicare. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommends mammography every 2 years in average risk women. And the biggest impact of mammography happens to be in the 60s. That's for the endpoint of breast cancer deaths. And so mammography in women, very important. colorectal cancer screening, boy, if there's one thing I really drive home to people, it's that you have to have some strategy. And if you're average risk, I personally don't care what strategy you choose. It could be FIT testing. It could be FIT testing plus DNA testing. It could be colonoscopy. It could be a virtual colonoscopy with CT scan. But if you're average risk, you just have to do something, and it has a huge impact on your chances of dying from colon cancer. If you're above average risk, if you've had polyps, if you have a family history of polyps or cancer, you can't really probably choose anything but colonoscopy. At least that's my philosophy. It's still the best test. Nobody looks forward to it. Trust me, I've been through it a number of times. But you know what? When it's all said and done, one of the reasons we've seen a decrease in colon cancer deaths is because with colonoscopy, which is much more widely available today than it was 20 years ago, people have the opportunity to have precancerous polyps removed before they turn into cancer. And that basically decreases the risk of cancer, colon cancer, as you get older. So really, all of those things are important. I would probably add a good screening skin examination. Most primary care clinicians can do that. I do it routinely on all of my annual exams. And so that would be kind of my core group of preventative cancer screenings that everyone needs to consider.
Yeah, I feel like that might have been for folks like myself who might elect to put off some medical treatment. That was the silver lining of the pandemic, was like, oh, shoot, you know, don't have to do those procedures that I've been putting off for a while. So what would you say to folks who may be hesitant or just maybe just nervous about going to the doctor or the hospital after the past year?
Well, yeah, I think they're certainly, and right now with the recent surge in COVID cases related to the Delta variant, I think there's a group of people that are nervous about coming. I can tell you, we still are screening everybody that comes into our clinics and hospitals. So we know that the people that are coming up to the clinic are asymptomatic and are not having active symptoms of COVID. We still mask in all patient care areas. We use eye protection, and we ask all of our patients to mask. So I think that we are doing everything we can to make it as safe as possible. We have had, I'm not aware of really any significant transmission between staff and patients. And so I would say make your appointment as soon as you can, get back on schedule and do those screening tests. There's one other screening test that I think we don't talk about enough, but it's really having a significant impact on probably the most common and lethal cancer out there, which is lung cancer, and that's lung cancer screening. Lung cancer is still the biggest contributor to cancer deaths in people in their 60s. And for decades, we've looked for a tool that would allow us to screen for lung cancer that would result in a decrease in the mortality rate. And finally, we came up with studies that showed that low-dose CT scanning actually could decrease the risk of dying from lung cancer in high-risk groups. And so this actually is covered by private insurance and Medicare. It can be done annually. It's a low-dose CT scan, so not a lot of radiation. It's typically done after the age of 55. There are a couple of caveats. It's only covered if you have no signs or symptoms of lung cancer and if you have a significant tobacco use history, and it requires an order from your clinician.
Sure. We're speaking with Dr. Michael Dolan this morning. He practices internal medicine and is a top administrator for the Gunderson Health System in La Crosse. He's joining us for the hour, and you can too. 1-800-642-1234. I'm Molly Stentz, and this is The Morning Show. Obesity rates among adults age 60 and older have been increasing. 2 out of 5 people are obese, and the older you are, the higher your risk for type 2 diabetes. Wisconsin Department of Health Services estimates that nearly 1 in 10 adults have been diagnosed with diabetes, and another third have pre-diabetes. Have you been screened? We're talking about healthy living in our 60s here on The Morning Show this morning. I'm Molly Stentz. With us is Dr. Michael Dolan from Gunderson Health Systems in La Crosse. You can join too, 1-800-642-1234. Also, email us, ideas@WPR.org. Well, Dr. Dolan, I want to talk about diabetes, but you mentioned something earlier that I wanted to follow up on, and that was the prostate cancer exam and the controversy there. Who should be concerned about prostate cancer screening?
Yeah, if there's anything that is more controversial than prostate cancer screening, I'm not really sure what it is, at least for a primary care clinician. The general consensus for now, based on the two most influential groups in the United States, the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force and the American Cancer Society, is that average risk men should discuss prostate cancer screening with their primary care clinician, making certain that they understand the risk and benefits of that screening prior to undertaking it. The problem really lies in what we consider to be an ideal screening test. The perfect screening test would allow us to detect a disease early enough to be able to treat it effectively, demonstrating an impact on long-term survival from that disease. That, of course, is part of the problem with prostate cancer, because for many men, prostate cancer can be a slow, indolent process that really has no impact on their life expectancy. And yet for others, it can be aggressive and have significant morbidity and mortality. Even the two largest studies that have ever been done in the history of cancer research, looking at the impact of prostate cancer screening, came to different conclusions, which really makes it even more difficult for us. The U.S. study, which was part of the prostate, lung, colorectal, and ovarian cancer screening trial, showed no difference in prostate cancer deaths in a screening group compared to usual care provided by primary care clinicians, which may have included PSA testing. The European study, looking at the same issue, showed a substantial reduction in prostate cancer mortality, about 20% after 13 years in men between the ages of 55 and 69. So in my conversation, I talk about those two studies, and then I offer them really the two options we have at this time for standard screening, which is PSA testing and or a digital rectal examination. They can do one or both. If the PSA is less than 2.5, then I typically retest it every 2 years. And if it's greater than 2.5, I would continue testing it annually. Screening should only be offered to men who have a life expectancy of 10 years or more due to the slow progression of this disease in most men. Interestingly, many men who do get prostate cancer actually die of another disease process. We have about 34,000 prostate cancer deaths in the U.S. every year. But interestingly, between 1992 and 2017, when screening really became part of what primary care clinicians offered to their patients, the death rate from prostate cancer actually declined from 39 to 19 deaths per 100,000 men. And many experts attribute that decline to the fact that we are doing more PSA screening. So it's a really difficult decision. And I have colleagues who really encourage men not to get PSA testing. And then others, especially my urologic colleagues, who recommend prostate cancer screening in average risk people who have a life expectancy greater than 10 years.
And so what age ranges are you recommending?
So in average risk people, I typically start offering PSA testing or having that discussion between age 50 and 55. Certainly if someone has a family history of prostate cancer, a brother, a father, or our higher risk ethnic groups such as a Black population, they would actually be at higher risk. And so they don't really fall into the average risk category. And I usually will lean towards encouraging PSA testing in that group.
Okay. Between 50 and 55. And then you mentioned there's a certain point at which maybe it's no longer required.
Yeah, you know, right now the data would say that the benefit is really between, for average risk men, is between age 55 and 69. I typically will stop at age 70 unless someone is in really good health and I feel like they have at least 10 additional years of high quality life. But usually 70 is where a lot of people will stop screening.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about diabetes and the risks that that come with aging. Are you seeing a greater awareness around this issue than in years past with pre-diabetes? I feel like we didn't hear so much about the term pre-diabetes years ago.
Sure. Yeah, we actually, you know, when I started practicing in 1990, the range of normal for a fasting glucose was up to 110. And we didn't refer to people between 110 and 126, which is the cutoff for diabetes, as pre-diabetic. We didn't talk about that. With the decrease in the normal range down to 100, under 100, we've actually added this category of pre-diabetes. And what we know is that about one in four pre-diabetics will go on to have diabetes at some point in their life. And of course, age is one of those factors that predisposes people to the development of diabetes. So we actually start to see more and more people in their 60s who develop either pre-diabetes or diabetes. Part of it is certainly our more sedentary lifestyle. We don't do as much activity to get our to burn off our glucose, and which is our fuel. And then the other thing is the increasing rates of obesity, because we know that fat is more resistant to insulin, and therefore your sugars will go up as a result. So those are probably the two biggest contributors, and without question, diet plays a huge role. People ask me, my pre-diabetic patients ask me, what can I do to get my sugar down? And I tell them that it sounds simple. You need to exercise more and you need to eat better. But that there's a lot that goes into that. There are programs. We have community programs as well as programs at Gunderson for pre-diabetics to learn all of the things that they can do to improve their and lower their blood sugar. And some of those programs have demonstrated incredible effectiveness. But it is the big epidemic that we see. I take care of more diabetics now than I have at any point in my career.
And who should be most concerned that they could be pre-diabetic?
So I do recommend that all my patients get that are not known to be diabetic or pre-diabetic get a fasting glucose every year. People at risk, without question, family history. So if you have a parent or a sibling that is diabetic, has type 2 diabetes, that increases your risk substantially. If you have both parents that are diabetic, and I have patients that are in that boat, your risk of developing type 2 diabetes is exceedingly high. In fact, in one of my patients, she has 8 siblings, and by the time they were all 65, all but her had diabetes. And when she turned 71, we diagnosed her with diabetes as well. So all 8 siblings have developed diabetes in the face of having both parents diabetic. Wow. So family is a huge, huge, plays a huge role in the development of diabetes. Certainly if you are obese with a BMI greater than 30, that increases your risk. And if you're sedentary, if you don't have a regular exercise program, then that is the third nail in the coffin, so to speak.
Well, what do you recommend for those of us who maybe put on a few pounds over the past pandemic year? You know, speaking for myself. So what would you recommend? How do people get back on the horse?
I think you start with a regular exercise program, and that's the thing is, I think the 60s are, you know, really a great opportunity to start to refocus on a healthy lifestyle. Believe it or not, the 60s are not too late to start focusing on healthy living habits like diet, exercise, and eliminating some unhealthy things like too much alcohol or tobacco use. And these changes changes that you make in your 60s can actually springboard you into a much longer and healthier life into your 70s and even 80s. I always like to use my dad as an example. So at 63, he had a major heart attack. And after that, he literally changed his lifestyle to include walking every day. And at first it was 5 minutes a day, then 10, then 15, then 45 minutes a day. And really for the next 19 years of his life, he was walking every day. And I think he was in better shape at 65 than he was at 45.
Oh, wow.
So it is never too late to start.
We're speaking with Dr. Michael Dolan here from Gunderson Health in La Crosse. We're at 1-800-642-1234. When's the last time you saw your family doc? Let us know. Up next is a news update. Talking about your health here on The Morning Show. I'm Molly Stentz in for Kate Archer-Kent. The current growth of the population aged 65 and older is unprecedented in U.S. history. In many parts of the country, especially counties in the rural Midwest, people are aging in place because disproportionate shares of young people have moved away. What did you do to prepare for growing older? What would you tell people about to enter their 60s? How is access to healthcare affecting your retirement plans? Join the conversation, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. With us is Dr. Michael Dolan, Executive Vice President and Medical Chief Operating Officer for Gunderson Health Systems. Well, Dr. Dolan, one thing that has also been on my mind is the risk of heart attacks, which increased throughout the 60s. And I wonder what advice you have to those of us with friends and family members who may seem healthy, maybe don't have a risk factor in their history, a family history of heart disease. What would you say to them about their risk of heart attacks as they age?
So it really starts with an honest assessment of what your risk factors are. So a lot of us use the Framingham risk calculator to determine what a person's 10-year risk for a cardiovascular event might be. And when I do that, I'm sometimes surprised because someone who on the outside looks like they really aren't at a significant risk, but when you actually go through the math of calculating that risk, you're actually surprised that their risk is higher than you might think. And so when we do that, we typically divide people into low risk, intermediate risk, and high risk. Low risk would be a risk of less than 5% of a cardiovascular event. That would be like a stroke or a heart attack in the next 10 years. Intermediate risk is actually a very large category. It's 5 to 20%. And then a high risk would be anything over 20%. The recommendation is that for high risk, we aggressively treat that person as if they have known coronary artery disease with typically antiplatelet therapy with an aspirin, as well as cholesterol lowering with a statin and making sure their blood pressure is well controlled. Intermediate risk, most people do recommend that you at least treat some of their risk factors like cholesterol modification. But that's been a real problem because there are certainly people in that intermediate risk that are actually have very low likelihood of developing a stroke or a heart attack just because, again, this calculation is not perfect. And so one of the things that is out there that probably not a lot of people talk about, but it's one of the things that I'm actually pretty interested in, is coronary artery calcium CT scoring or CAC scores. And this is one of those things that, again, you get differing opinions from different groups. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force doesn't feel that there's enough evidence to support it to improve cardiovascular risk assessment in asymptomatic adults. But the American College of Cardiologists and American Heart Association actually do recommend it to try and help that intermediate risk group try and determine a better idea of where their risk is. So
this,
what is the...
this coronary calcium scan, how does it work?
Yep. So it's the CAC score is actually a really simple test. It's basically a low-dose CT scan, similar to the lung cancer screening exam, equal to about 1.5 chest x-rays. And what it does is they scan the area where the heart is, and they look for a buildup of calcium in the coronary arteries. Calcium buildup in the arteries is a natural endpoint of atherosclerosis. And so this test actually allows us to quantify how much coronary artery disease might be present in an individual. So what I do with this test, if I have somebody who's intermediate risk, who really is not interested in going on a cholesterol-lowering medication, then what I do is I offer them the CAC score as a means of saying whether or not that we can restratify them. So what does that mean? Well, if you do a CAC score and you find out that you have coronary arteries that have evidence of atherosclerosis, what I've found is people are way more likely to go on the appropriate medication to try and prevent a stroke or a heart attack down the road. But if that test comes back as zero, I mean, your arteries are clean, that's actually a reason to say, boy, maybe you don't need to be aggressive with your risk factor modification. And so sometimes I'll actually say, you don't need to go on a cholesterol lowering medication, even though you're at an intermediate risk of 9% or 12%. And so it's a really nice way to kind of further divide or risk stratify people.
So is it the visual? Is it the fact that it's you're kind of taking it out of just the hypothetical math probability and into like look at this picture and see what is happening inside your body?
It is absolutely correct. In fact, I will pull up the pictures and show people what it looks like, and oftentimes they cannot start a cholesterol lowering medication fast enough if you can show them evidence that they already have atherosclerosis. The problem is without support from the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, insurance companies don't cover this as a test. And you'd think, well, a CT scan, that could be really expensive. I will tell you that most health systems, including ours, offer CAC scoring as a really inexpensive screening option, usually between $150 and $250 out of pocket. And I have yet to have a person say, no, I don't really want to spend that, because that turns out to be sometimes less than the copay on a regular CT scan. And you're getting a radiologist that's looking at the lungs and a cardiologist that's looking at the heart. So I think it's one of the great bargains in our set of tools that we have to screen people for heart disease.
And why did you say that it's commonly not covered by insurance?
Well, because the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force says that there is not enough evidence to support its use in risk stratification for cardiovascular disease. And so a lot of insurance companies, including Medicare, use that the recommendations of the USPTF as a way to determine what they're going to cover.
Okay. So basically the thinking is that it's an extra precaution, but perhaps not essential.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, that's their recommendation. However, again, the American College of Cardiology and the American Heart Association actually disagree with that. There are multiple studies going on to try and get better evidence to show a benefit, and I'm hoping that over the next 2 to 5 years that we'll have enough evidence to get the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force to cover that as a potential screening tool in intermediate risk individuals.
So maybe you're just ahead of the curve.
We'll see.
So we're talking with Dr. Michael Dolan from the Gunderson Health Systems in La Crosse. We're taking your questions this morning about your health. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org. Well, Dr. Dolan, you mentioned the word Medicare, and I feel like that is such a big topic that we would be remiss in not addressing when people are thinking about making that transition, either from a private plan, from a business plan to Medicare. It can be such a big deal and so complicated. how often are you able to counsel your patients about what they'll need for the years ahead and whether Medicare will be sufficient for them?
Sure. Yeah. I try not to get into the insurance discussion, mostly because I am somewhat biased. Gunderson, of course, is affiliated with Quartz Health Solutions, which is an insurance provider-owned insurance company with UW-Madison.
Yeah.
Without question, the transition to Medicare is one of the big transitional moments in the decade of the 60s. And for some people, moving from employer-sponsored health insurance to Medicare can be scary. And for other people, they actually look forward to it because it frees them up to basically move forward with retirement. They don't feel tied to that employer to get healthcare coverage. So Medicare can be very daunting. There are a lot of choices with Medicare. There's standard Medicare, and then there are the Medicare Advantage plans, which tend to either be less expensive or have more benefits associated with them. But in return, it ties you to a particular set of providers and clinicians and health systems. It's really interesting. Medicare actually covers a lot of really good things that are including screening blood tests and screening tests like aortic aneurysm screening. A lot of people really forget about that one, but Medicare will cover that test once in your life. If you are considered at risk, people who would be covered would be anyone who has a family history of a aortic aneurysm or a thoracic aneurysm, and then any male who has smoked more than 100 cigarettes in their lifetime. Those are the people that are at risk for aortic aneurysms, which can be a really significant cause of morbidity and death as people get older. So that's a great benefit. It will cover bone density screening in women and high-risk males. So there are really some great benefits tied to Medicare. They've got the Medicare annual wellness visit, which has, I would say, people that are feel it's a great benefit and others who feel it could do more. Great. It's a great opportunity for people to figure out what they really want from their Medicare program as they age.
We're speaking with Dr. Michael Dolan. He practices internal medicine and is a top administrator for Gunderson Health Systems in La Crosse. He stays with us for the hour. You can join in 1-800-642-1234. This is Molly Stentz, and you're listening to The Morning Show. We're talking about how to stay healthy as we age. I'm Molly Stentz. This is The Morning Show. When's the last time you were in to see your family doc? How quickly were you able to get an appointment? How much does access to health care figure into your retirement plans? We're at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. With us is Dr. Michael Dolan, Medical Chief Operating Officer for Gunderson Health Systems in La Crosse. Well, Dr. Dolan, we have a caller for you. We have Scott joining us from Whitewater with a question. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning. Thank you for having this program, by the way. I'm in my mid-60s now, and when I was like 62 or so, I had one of those calcium scans because my physician was concerned with my cholesterol. And the calcium scan came back with a score of 4. And my physician seemed kind of agitated that it was that low. And he never really gave me a indication of what that meant. And I was just kind of curious if the doctor could somewhat address that.
Thanks, Scott.
Absolutely. Scott, that's a great question. So the scoring system for the CAC score is actually called the Eggleston score. And it's a computer-derived program that looks at the amount of calcium that's within the wall of the arteries. And it looks at each artery individually and then totals it up. So I'm assuming that your total score was 4. So that's a really low score. It's not zero, so it's not a perfect score, but it's a really low score. And I would say anything less than 10 actually is associated with a very low risk of coronary events over the next 10 years. Would I take cholesterol medication? So I don't know what your 10-year Framingham risk score would be, what that percent, probably somewhere between 5 and 20% if your doctor recommended that test. So I might actually recommend that you be on a cholesterol-lowering medication to try and prevent that 4 from increasing to a higher level. And then you might want to consider repeating that scan in about 5 years. That's currently the recommended interval for people that want to follow that number. If you had it at 62, maybe consider repeating at 67 to see if there's been any progression.
And so what score are you hoping for, Dr. Dolan?
Zero.
Okay.
You want zero. Here's a test where you really want it to be low. I have seen results that have been zero, and I have seen results that have been over 1,600. That's a pretty high score, and that would be associated with a pretty significant coronary artery disease burden.
All right.
Well, so, yeah, zero would be an ideal score for that test.
And what score would those cholesterol lowering medications help you?
Most people would say anything that's not zero.
Okay.
It's probably that simple. Certainly less than 10 is a low risk. 10 to 100 is considered mild risk. 100 to 400 is considered moderate risk, and anything over 400 is considered high risk.
Sure. Well, I hope that answered your question, Scott. Thank you for calling in. If you'd like to join the conversation, we're at 1-800-642.
Yeah, that was a great question, Molly.
Yes, thanks. Well, Dr. Dolan, I want to ask you about something on my mind, and that's the opioid epidemic and changing advice around prescription drugs and opioid painkillers. I wonder if your approach to that has changed over the years.
Fortunately, I think that my personal approach hasn't changed a lot, because I've always felt that while opioids have a role in pain management, they are not the only option that we have. I think that for our health system in general, we've seen a real change. Part of that dates back to the mid-2000s, when we developed a program in our disease management tracking system for chronic opioid use. And we were actually surprised how many patients within our health system were on opioids long-term. And so we tracked that. We reported that information back to the clinicians so that they could manage that group of patients. We gave them the tools. And so we were a little bit ahead of the game compared to many places. I think that over the last few years, we've continued to see a push away from just indiscriminate prescribing of opioids. You know, it was pretty common for a post-operative patient to be prescribed, 40 Lortab tablets with 3 refills after a minor surgical procedure. I think that was pretty commonplace. And now our surgeons are really good about giving patients that may have a need for a pain medication, either something that's not an opioid or an opioid for a very small number of pills, typically 10 to 15 with no refills. And that helps to decrease the number of those tablets that are out and about in our communities. So I think that we've definitely seen that. Now, this week, a little alarming, there was a recent court case where a patient's family sued a pain clinic for not providing a refill of pain medication that had been prescribed by other clinicians. And the patient ultimately committed suicide, and that resulted in a lawsuit that was actually the jury settlement was for $7 million. So I'm a little nervous about that. There's going to be an increased pressure on clinicians to continue prescribing opioids that may or may not be indicated. So I think the key really for appropriate use of opioids is to make sure that they're, A, make sure you've done a really good history and physical exam to know that there's a reason to prescribe, and then to make sure that you are aware of how much or how big the need is for that particular patient. So it's a very difficult situation.
Well, and Dr. Dolan, we have a caller now that I want to squeak in here as we approach the end of the hour. Let's go to Appleton, where Lou's joining us this morning. Good morning, Lou.
Oh, hi. I wanted to mention the calcium score test. I did have that several years ago, and my score was zero. And yet I do have a little bit higher cholesterol, about 225. And my doctor mentioned something about cholesterol med, but I know people who've been on the cholesterol med, and they do get side effects from it. It's not just going on a med and you know, it lowers your cholesterol. And so I was hesitant to do that. I'm just wondering, you know, with a zero score, how necessary is it for me to go on to a cholesterol medicine?
Great question, Lou.
Lou, that's awesome. Great question. Appleton, near and dear to my heart as a Lawrence University grad. So I'm going to say that the most important thing about that 225 cholesterol is what the breakdown is, because if that breakdown is mostly HDL cholesterol, if you have a high HDL cholesterol, your risk is actually significantly decreased with that. So it's not just the total number that really matters. You need to look at the big picture. If you have a really high LDL to HDL ratio, so LDL being the bad cholesterol, HDL being the good cholesterol, I have people that have cholesterols of 270, but their HDL cholesterol is 110. I can tell you that their risk for coronary or cardiovascular disease is very low. And so I would say that you need to know the breakdown of those, of what that cholesterol really looks like. And then the second thing is that, at this point, with a zero, congratulations, that's really good. I would say that I also would be reluctant to take a statin drug, knowing that I have no evidence of coronary artery disease on that scan. But I'd probably repeat the scan in 5 years if my cholesterol tells me that I'm at higher risk.
Thank you for that call. Well, Dr. Dolan, we are up against the clock right at the end of our hour. Any last tips you want to share with everyone this morning?
Yeah, you know, again, the 60s are such a momentous decade of transition. You know, we're moving from being employed to maybe moving towards retirement, the insurance changes, but it's never too late to focus on those healthy habits, diet, exercise.
Thank you.
All that.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Michael Molly. Dolan from Gunderson Health System in La Crosse. I'm Molly Stentz, and this is The Morning Show.